Our next speaker is Sarah Zammit. She is a documentary filmmaker living in Toronto. Her last film is entitled Corporate Lockdown, looking at privatization of Canada's first adult facility. She is currently working with women in the federal prison system in a documentary looking at issues facing older women in prison and upon release. Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you. I just wanted to add that my work in the prison system came out of an experience with my brother being incarcerated about 10 years ago, and he died subsequently upon release, and my work as an activist at the time, I just kept coming back to issues in the criminal justice system and really trying to bring out stories that shed light onto what's really happening on the inside. So in 2000 and 2001, I started making a documentary looking at the entire criminal justice system and sort of the history of the criminal justice system. And it would have been a sort of a 10-part epic series, but it ended up just reminding people to look at the issues of the fact that the discussion isn't really about privatization, but it's really about how prisons are being run, whether they're publicly run or privately run. And the fact that basically people aren't rehabilitated. My brother went through the system. He was a drug user. He ended up dying of drugs. And when he was released from prison, we had a little certificate of his rehabilitation program for drugs and et cetera. And we sort of put it on his coffin. I just think that prisons, there should be a constant scrutiny on prisons. So what I ended up doing was following community in Penetanguishene and taking a look at private the struggle to not have the prison privately run. I was asked to come here today to speak just sort of generally about private prisons, so sort of private prison 101 kind of thing. So privatization, basically it's the transfer of responsibilities from the public sector to the private sector. And what I'm going to focus on today is private prison management. The other things that we can look at is sort of the financing of the prison and prison construction. The one in Penetanguishene was contracted out to Ellis Dawn, the private prison in Penetanguishene, and the one in Lindsay cost about $92 million to make. And the ownership was retained by the government of Ontario. Other contractors in the U.S. Actually end up owning the prisons when they make them, and sometimes they build them in advance and then get the contract from governments to fill them. The other thing are private prison industries. In Canada, there's CORCAN, and that is something that is prisoner inmates. It's sort of a separate arm's length organization, so it's not a government agency, so to speak, to begin with. It's got somewhat of a special status. In the U.S., it's Unicor, and they had a caption on their website, which was, you know, some people have captive audiences. We have captive employees, so that sort of sets the stage for what kinds of things are going on. The other thing is, the discussion around privatization was interesting at the time, and a lot of attention was put on the management of prisons and, you know, switching over to privately run, but the reality is, in fact, that a lot of the services in prison are already contracted out. So education, medical personnel, food services, programming, etc. I would say, 70 to 80% of the services were already contracted out. So in fact, privatization is pretty firmly entrenched in Canada. So I think that was a fact that wasn't really known to a lot of people. Initially, in the 1800s, all prisons were privately run, and sort of over time, government took more and more control of managing these prisons. And it was interesting when I started to work on the film and do a lot of research, a lot of the countries in Canada or around the world had started to shy away and sort of seen that private prisons weren't the panacea that they had hoped, and it sort of wasn't the answer. And the abuses, the lack of accountability, the resulting in deaths, and the sort of confusion around legislation and who runs what and who gets charged with what, and sort of any kind of recourse or accountability for inmates, recourse or accountability for families, or anyone who was sort of looking to challenge the private prison companies around their practices were finding it very difficult to do so. And I think that's still the case in Canada here today. Other things that have been privatized are surveillance technologies, and Canadian companies are some of the companies that provide a lot of surveillance technologies around the world to private prison companies. So it was interesting at the time of the Mike Harris government when people started to really look at private prisons for Canada. The rest of the world has, you know, meaning who were really at the forefront of privatizing most of their, or trying to privatize most of their prison systems, the UK, Australia, the US, of course, and New Zealand. And, you know, public sentiment in those countries had really sort of started shifting away from private prison management and sort of back to where it should be in discussions of alternatives to incarceration. Of course, you know, the private prisons are still firmly entrenched in all of these countries, but definitely the criticism and the voices of dissent were out there and had even reached the mainstream, and that information had come to Canada. And Mike Harris and his gang sort of refused to take notice of that and, you know, started turning their attention to something that they saw as a new solution, which of course it was not. So what happened in 2001 in Penetanguishene, a company called Management and Training Corporation won the bid to run the first private prison in Canada, and they're a Utah-based company, and First Correctional Medical takes care of all the medical issues in the jail. And there's lots of documentation of the health and medical problems, some resulting in death and the neglect basically that's happening in that facility, and I'm sure many of you here are aware of all of that. So the, you know, the main logic behind privatization is arguing that that private companies can run jails cheaper than public companies and, or than the government, and that's just not proven to be the case anywhere. There's very little documentation out there that supports concretely the fact that private prisons can run prisons more effectively or, and more cost effectively than public companies or public government. I mean, there's obvious issues related to privatization, and one of those is, of course, ethical issues. A corporation making a profit from the incarceration of individuals, and, you know, we're seeing that increased commodification of the prisoner and the increased exploitation of the prisoner, the prisoner's labor, and that's really seen through private companies that, such as Unicor. And I think CorCan is sort of moving towards that, the selling of goods and a profit being made off labor directly. Privatization allows the profit to go directly from the prisoner coming into the prison directly to the corporation. So they have a vested interest in filling the jails. So obviously, if you're answerable to your shareholders, you are going to want to have your profits increase, and the only way to have your profits increase is to fill your prisons. And so one obvious ethical consideration is the sort of shared public-private partnerships, which allow an overlap between government and corporate interests. And in Ontario, and there's examples of this around the world, where this has resulted in really favorable conditions for governments to put more and more people in jail. In Ontario, it was really clear with the Harris government basically cutting welfare by 21%, lowering, getting rid of rent control, eliminating second stage housing, streamlining court systems. There's some federal initiatives to have minimum mandatory sentencing. There's really targeting of, you know, this racist targeting of lower economic communities. And this sort of set up a flow for a really steady stream of people to just start pumping through the system. So this was happening at the same time as these negotiations around privatization. And one interesting story, which didn't seem to get too much attention, was the fact that the Harris government hired two people as independent experts to advise them on the transition from a publicly run jail to a privately run jail. These two so-called experts were in fact people who had links to Management and Training Corporation. So they were in fact working, you know, in tandem with the company that won the bid for the jail in Penetanguishene. So, you know, it suggests that there are these links and relationships that are being formed, and, you know, it really begs the question whether these kinds of private companies should have any vested interest in discussing any kind of criminal justice policy in any long-term way. You know, obviously the quality of service is one thing that the private prison companies say that they can provide a quality of service for a much reduced price, and they end up usually cutting wages. A lot of the private prison companies are not unionized and are never unionized at the beginning. Some have been able to be unionized. And so there's a lot less staff, there's a more reliance on technology, and you know, this sort of setup of corrections and management style has really compromised the safety even more so to people in prison, and has really minimized their access to services, programming, transitional services, vocational services, educational services, adequate food, adequate healthcare, and you know, and on and on. So I'm gonna stop there, but just to say once again, which I probably didn't say very well at the beginning, but you know, for me the discussion is really not whether private run prisons are better than publicly run prisons. It's to really examine the presence of prisons and to explore and examine the criminal justice system as a whole, to look at who it's really benefiting. And that was my impetus really for starting the film, is who really benefits from the existence of prisons.
Thank you very much, Sarah. Our next speaker is Denise Burnett. Years ago, the Minister Farah Khan had suggested to the Black community that they adopt an inmate. Denise did. The inmate that she has been visiting for the past 3 years is now a part of her family. Denise was a radio broadcaster on CIUT 89.5 FM. She is a social worker based in Toronto and works with homeless youth aged 16 to 24. Denise is a Black single mom of two and an advocate for equal rights and justice for all. She has actively participated in protests and demonstrations against police brutality and will continue to advocate for those who can't. Thanks, Denise.
Thank you. About 3 years ago, I started visiting this inmate that I adopted, quite notorious inmate. Very well-known case. His name is Clinton Gale Jr. And Clinton was involved in a police shooting in 1994 in the Jane and Trithewey area, where Officer Todd Bayless ended up dead when the smoke cleared. And for years I recognized him as a prisoner of war on the program that I hosted at CIUT, primarily because he shot back. And before that incident in 1994, there were 20 years of police officers shooting young Black youth in this city. And I was appalled. I couldn't believe that this was actually happening and we were living in a democracy. And it so happened that a friend of a friend called me 3 years ago on June 16th when I mentioned Clinton and said, "You're the only one that remembers him. And he calls me periodically. Can I hook a sister up?" And I thought, okay. Of course, hook a sister up. And I spoke with him for about 6 months before I actually picked up enough gumption to go up there and visit him. And I had absolutely no clue what I was getting myself into. I went up there and they would swipe my jewelry on this ion machine. And in swiping it, they would put it in the machine and either it didn't make a sound or it made a sound. And you were allowed to have a certain amount of substance could be detected, but it had to be within the barriers of what the machine said was normal. And for about 2.5 years in going up there, the machine never went off. And I thought, damn, I'm good. I must be good. This is even better. Like, you know, because I've never had a criminal record. I've never been convicted of any criminal charge. Don't have a police record in any way, never been stopped or given even a traffic ticket. Could be that I don't drive. And so I knew of the police, and I'm a law and order junkie, and I'm a CSI junkie, so it's like, okay, we can do this. Went in there. On the 26th of December of last year, I went up to see Clinton, and they have a dog. So after you go through the machine, you have to then go through the dog. The dog is God, period. And you always wonder, how the hell do you name the dog God? But it's true, the dog is God in prison. This dog sat, and that is all it took for me to be denied visits. Remember, no drug history, never seen heroin, never seen coke, ain't into that, don't play that, right? And yet this dog sat and I was denied a visit. couple weeks ago, I went up there again, and the man swiped my machine, my necklace. And usually the machine goes beep, 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 beep. I swear to God, it sounded like a cow horn. I just went, I said, what the hell is that? He goes, well, we got problems. And I'm like, what kind of problems? He's going, 280 points above the level for heroin on my necklace. Well, conniption wasn't even the word. My body started to shake. I was ready to convulse and turn into this monster of, what do you mean? What are you talking about? I don't have heroin on my necklace. And, you know, it's all about how you carry yourself, because I've seen 68-year-old mothers go up there to visit their sons and be turned away visits because guards believe they have hash on their shoes. I've been up there and I've seen grandmothers that are visiting Canada and get the opportunity to go visit their grandson incarcerated and be turned away because they believe they've been in touch with marijuana. Yet in the same sense, I've seen women go in to visit men and hooped something and unhooped it, and he's hooped it right in the visiting room, and nobody saw that. The interesting aspect about visiting anybody in prison is how you then become the criminal because you're visiting someone in prison. The system encourages you to support your family members and your loved ones when they're incarcerated, but they make it the most difficult task you'll ever do. You literally have to muscle up your conscience and say, you know what, I'm gonna go in there. And before you go in there, you gotta get the alcohol swipe, and you gotta wipe all your jewelry, and you gotta wash all your keys, and you gotta wash your hands, and you gotta make sure you prepare yourself, because you spend 3 hours to get up to Millhaven only to be turned away. And you have to wait on the John Howard bus to do the milk run of visiting all the institutions and dropping all the wives off and having come back for you before you can actually leave the institution. So the 2.5 hour visit is denied, and you still have to wait the duration of the 2.5 hour visit in order to be able to return home. I have seen some things that make me realize that as a human being, we are ugly. We are very, very ugly. When it comes to the guards, I question how they sleep at night, and they do. You know why? They have no conscience. It doesn't bother them. Yet, if the role was reversed, they would not want to be treated the same way in which they treat guards. And don't get me wrong, I'm not supporting the fact that they're not in there for a reason. Right? They're in there for a reason. But while they're in there for a reason, they're entitled to the fundamental rights as human beings. They're entitled to brush their teeth with toothpaste that doesn't say warning if swallowed, call 911. How are you gonna do that in prison? How are you gonna call 911 in prison? There's no dial pads on the phone. Who's gonna save you if you do swallow that toothpaste? And why is it when I bring him toothpaste, he's denied it because it's not on his list? Aren't we all entitled to brush our teeth? Don't we have the basic right to a shower? Should someone have to wait 5 days, 10 days for a shower based on the prison being on lockdown? Does it have to happen where it's 2 men at a time that have to take a 5-second shower so that everybody else can have a shower? Is that the way we want? Is that what we're doing to rehabilitate those that we say have done wrong in our society? We have a lot to wake up to. We have a whole heap to wake up to. The most amazing thing that I see, though, I'm a mother. I have a 22-year-old son, and anything can happen. You know, I don't swear by it. Anything can happen, right? In the heat of the moment, anger, frustration, anything can happen. And I would hope that God would give me the strength to be able to support him in that experience, and that he would come out with a lesson learned, not more criminalized based on where they sent them. And I think before we can even address this, we have to look at it on the outside from within. Because if you don't go within, we're all gonna go without. You know, my dad said to me when I was growing up, if you're gonna be a thief, you better make sure you're a damn good thief. Because prison is not made for dogs. It's made for human beings. But yet they treat you like dogs in these institutions. And that's where our taxpayers go. You know, and in closing, Clinton's been sitting in a maximum security prison now for 8 years. 2 years prior to, he was in the provincial court system, and 8 years in Millhaven. 2 years after conviction into a maximum security prison, you're entitled to be transferred into a medium security prison. He has been granted approval over and over again. And we are told it's not the right time. We are told it's election time. We are told to be patient, and it's been 8 years. It's been 8 years. Are we teaching him anything when he went in there at 26 and now 36, 10 years later, he's still sitting in the same situation? We have a lot to be concerned about with how our government is running these institutions. And in particular, my community. Because every week that I go up there, there's at least half a dozen young black youth, 21, 22 years old, that are serving life sentences. We have to question why. You know, it is about the solutions. That's the key to it. It is about solutions. And I think if we do it as a collective, regardless of race, gender, age, if we do it as a collective, we're capable of making that change. But we have to get to that point first. Thank you.
Our next speaker is Sabrina. She's a member of PASAN Speakers Bureau. She is also HIV positive, preoperative transsexual woman, male to female. She has done more or less two small bits and one large bit. She served her time in Don Jail, the East Detention Center, Millbrook, and Guelph, which are all men's prisons. Welcome, Sabrina.
Hello, I'd like to thank everybody that's here, first of all. I really appreciate you all coming. I think a day like today is very good for us all, considering me being an inmate at all. First of all, I want to tell you I'm 34 years old. I've been HIV positive since 95. I've been through the prison system quite a few times, actually. The two bits I'm talking about was one was for 8 months, and the first one was weekends. All right, that was a little different for me at being 19. And then when I got into about 3 or 4 years later, I got into the drugs, of course. That always happens. Inside jail is really, really hard for a person being transgender, first of all, and then being gay, even, or being a lesbian. I could just imagine what it's like over for the women. But in the men's institution, it's like so hush-hush, but God only knows what goes on behind closed doors. Believe me, there's a lot. But there's a lot of things in jail that really need to be worked with. And then I think that what we need to actually get across here tonight is to let you know that the cutbacks and the privatizations is going to make so many people fall through the cracks. And they're falling through the cracks now. It's unbelievable. If we're talking about people with hep C, HIV, cancer. We're talking with these people that are very seriously sick, and they're not being taken care of. They're not being. The government is doing very little, very, very little. I'm speaking from, I know, I'm HIV positive. I started medications. It took me 2 months to get onto medications in the jail, and I was on the medications even before I came into the jail. It was just so much red tape to get through your doctor. If it wasn't for PASAN, I probably wouldn't be able to get onto my drug regime, do you know? And then the biggest bit, that was my most memorable bit, was the 2 years less a day. I should have took the deuce and went to the big house, especially what I went through. I went to Millbrook, which is 18 hours lockdown. You're only out from 6 until 11 in the nights, and then weekends you're only out from like, I think it's like 1 in the afternoon, and you go back in at 5 and you come back. But these prisons really, really work hard on keeping people locked up, and the guards there are so racist. And I mean, just not just because you're gay, it's true. It has to do with your color, it has to do with who you are and what you stand for. Believe me, it does. And there's so many people that are in there with different religions and different cultures and different, so many different issues. And these guards literally come down and they attack these prisoners. They interrogate them and they make them angry and upset, so they want to see them break up so they can make them go to the hole, which is segregation, if a lot of you don't understand that. And segregation is where there's a lot. You can actually hear screams from guards hitting people down there. In Millbrook, it did happen there when I was there. I heard it a couple of times. And it's pretty serious when some of these inmates come out 2 or 3 weeks later and you can see cuts and bruises and still from what's going on from these guards, because these people stuck up for their rights. They stuck up for who they were and who what they believed in. Do you know what I mean? It's really hard for some people to come out there that are biased in power and what power really does to them, especially these guards. A lot of these guards. I know in the federal system it's a lot different. In the provincial system they get away with a lot more because people that are doing life don't really give a shit. Then those guards know it. So down there there's more respect there. That much I know of. Speaking through people going in and out of the system, I know that much. So what I really want to get across here is that we have to really, really think about the provincial jails, okay? And if they go privatized, seriously go privatized, we're really, really going to get hurt. And the people that are going to hurt the most are the people that are HIV positive, the people that are sick, and the, like I said before, and the people that have issues, especially with the Islam, okay? Especially after 9/11. We all know what happened on 9/11. Oh my good Lord, I was in jail, like, 3 months after that. That's the last time I've been in jail, was in 2002. And when I went in there, if you were Islam, oh my Lord, the inmates were on top of you, and then the guards were on top of you. Do you know what I mean? It was just so unbelievable. Unbelievable. It's just something that we need to understand, something that everybody has a right to be free. Everybody has a right to have food, shelter, proper medication. And just because you've done a crime, from no matter what, people have done crimes for, like, the sex crimes, well, I don't even get started there. I don't believe in people that have rehabilitation for them. I think we should just lock them up, throw away the key. That's how I feel about sex crimes. But with robberies related to drug problems, or from issues from mental illness, child abuse, everything, the molestations that you've gone through in your life, some of these people have gone through, men and women, more women, especially with the molestation. These people need help. They need help. The reason why they're acting out and the reason why they are going into jail system is because they've been abused one way or another. And that's what we need in these jails. We don't need these jails going private. We don't need these jails going like whatever, because it's just going to be stupid. It really is. It's going to get worse and there's going to be more riots and it's going to turn out to be like Oz. You ever seen that show Oz? How many of you here watch that show Oz? Oh, come on, the men in there. Hello, ladies, let's see it. You know what I'm saying? Alright, okay. Let's get back to the point here. You know, my purpose of being here is I'm an HIV positive transgender, okay. Okay, I'm going to be blunt, not to disrespect women in here, but I'm going to tell you, a man with tits going through a jail, guards are blown. The inmates are blown. And I'm telling you, it took me a long goddamn time, but when I got sick, well, I did get a bra out of them. It took me about 4 months, but I got a bra out of them. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sabrina.